Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. I feel very blessed to be chatting with this couple this morning, Robbie and Frank Pack. They're from Fairfield, and I got connected to them because they heard an interview I did a couple weeks back with a missionary who had done some time over in Ukraine, a couple of years over there. And it turns out that this couple have been doing short-term mission trips to Ukraine since 2001, over 22 years. And I wanted to hear from them this morning, especially in response to what's going on, hear some of their stories and how much it's changed in 22 years. Good morning to you both. Thank you for being here. How are you?
We're just fine. Thank you, Melissa.
So I'll start with you, Frankie, because Robbie, for reaching out to us about this. What kind of drew you to Ukraine? Why Ukraine?
Well, Frank heard a gentleman talking about bringing Bibles translated into Ukrainian and Russian, a man from the Bible League, and he talked about Ukraine. And literally God burned in his heart that he was to go to Ukraine. I had already been to Brazil, and part of my heart was there, and so I tried to convince him to go to Brazil instead. Mm-hmm. But the short story is that we both went to Ukraine, and when I got there, the Lord burned my heart for the women of Ukraine, mm-hmm. and both of us have learned to love both men and women in Ukraine over the years. We've done teaching of healing to pastors and leaders. We helped establish an orphanage in a village called Blagodagnia, which is the village of grace in the middle of the wheat belt there. We've helped establish or support drug rehab centers for both men and women. We've visited with Holocaust survivors to honor them and hear their stories. And we've taught in what used to be an underground Bible school, which is now very public. And we've done refugee support since 2014 for those in those areas that were taken in the war early on.
So I want to... go for it, Frank. Yes, please.
Yeah, another thing we've done, which, you experience stuff and see the need, and then you respond. And in Nikolaev, Ukraine, is where we helped establish the first women's medical center in that region back in early 2000s. And it was just turned out to be such a blessing that people, women, were often overlooked as far as their needs. And it was just a real blessing to be a part of that, to help see them get the medical help they need.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. I mean, even hearing about like the underground Bible school that has now, mm-hmm. 20 plus years later, is now very much public and very much alive and well, which is beautiful. Now, were you guys there before, during, or after Ukraine got its independence?
It was after they got their independence, and we went with about 3 weeks after 9/11 happened, and
wow.
We were the first or second airplane to take off of Kennedy to go overseas after, they allowed the flights to continue then.
I would imagine with 22 years under your belt of going back and forth, you have many friends and loved ones there.
Yes. Well, we do. We've been to southern Ukraine, Odessa, Nikolaev, and other cities, Zaporizhia, Kharkiv, which is basically some of these places are completely destroyed now. And then western Ukraine, I've been to a couple times.
In
Kyiv, of course, the capital, and major cities. We've been to all the major cities in Ukraine, and such lovely people, very gracious, and they would give the shirt off the back for a stranger in need. And that's the soul of Ukraine. They're just a peace-loving people.
So what is it like, especially, Frank, you just mentioned that there are places you have been to, frequented to, and they're not even there anymore. What is it like for both of you to watch what's unfolding overseas?
It just your heart just wrenched and ripped apart because we see photographs of people that have fled the war in 2014. Now they're fleeing again for their lives. And babushkas who can't leave,
the grandmothers
who have to stay. And, you know, many of them are dead now. But our heart has been to help humanitarian aid, and we've been involved in that since 2014. And we work with people who are basically don't look for attention. They just do what they need to do for the country. And the stories we hear and experience, we're in constant contact with some key leaders there, and they just work day and night to get food and water and a special heart for the little children and the elderly and families. But it's just heart-wrenching. We have to turn the news off for 24 hours sometimes because it just gets too much to process.
It is a lot to process. I know I've been feeling a tremendous pull from even my grandparents who have since passed, but we're originally from Kyiv. The Sheketov side of me is originally from Kyiv. And when you said babushka, that brought me back as a babushka, deduska. So I knew that reference very quickly. But it's very hard to watch what's being done. And if for something that just seems like it's kind of happening in slow motion, and it just doesn't seem like an end in sight. When do you plan to go back? What is your plan now? I've got to imagine you guys are itching to figure out something, even going to Poland or something, or seeing your friends.
I personally would tell my wife, Robbie, I said, you know what? If God tells me to go to Ukraine, even in the midst of this, I'm going. We don't know. Right now, the best thing we can do is raise funds here. Mm. And to help support those on the ground in Ukraine who get humanitarian aid to people, and also very much involved in rescuing people. And the individuals we work with have been able to, right by now, it's got to be up close to more than 1,000 people they've rescued. And they tend to target those who are elderly, those who are sick, and those with you know, single moms or young families.
With too many children to handle all by herself on the train, like there was a mom with 7 children. Can you imagine traveling with 7 children, your basic belongings, and try to keep them together in the crowds that you have pushing toward the doors of the trains? You multiply what you see in Fairfield train station by probably 100-fold, and that's how many people. It's just a sea of people waiting, trying to get closer to the train door to get on the train. So they've rescued those types of people as well.
Wow.
As the ones that simply can't travel easily. They've gotten wheelchairs for people. They've really worked to help those who really can't get out in the ways that the masses are getting out.
We're chatting this morning with an incredible couple from Fairfield, Frank and Robbie Pack, who have spent the last 22 years on and off doing mission trips in Ukraine. And right before the break, Frank and Robbie, you had mentioned that you're going to do all you can to raise funds, to get donations sent over there, and you kind of gave us a snapshot of just some of the needs. I have people constantly in the last couple of weeks asking, what can I give? What can I do? Do you have either specific nonprofits you're working with? Are you guys doing a private collection? You know, how can people help you guys in the mission you are taking on with Ukraine?
We've been directing everyone to give through our church. They're doing it with no charge. They're paying for the wiring of funds over there. It's yourgateway.com, and you click on the give button on the drop down menu. You look for Ukraine and put Ukraine the Packs. So it's yourgateway.com, give Ukraine the Packs. You can also call their phone number at
203-934-0880. And choose on the voice menu, and someone will get back to you or answer the phone. They have been very supportive of all of our efforts and have been very instrumental in raising you know, making the needs known, and we require accountability of all the money that is sent over. It's sent safely, so it gets there. We confirm it very quickly, and it's put to immediate use for temporary housing, food, water, clothing, and everything. And it's really been a major effort to help people out.
And it's run by a pastor, and there are pastors and members of various congregations helping over there. They've been doing it since 2014, when the first part of the war started, and so they're very experienced in handling the funds. It's tax deductible, and 100% of it goes over.
Okay, so what is the website? One more time, guys.
Sure. yourgateway.com, and then you click on Give.
Donate.
Give Ukraine the PACs.
Okay. Well, we thank you both so much for sharing your stories here on the air, sharing that information so people can support those in Ukraine. You know, really quick question, just because I have you guys here, Robbie and Frank. Do you know, because I've had a couple inquiries about this, and I even myself, believe it or not, so I'm very religious for any of my listeners who don't know, but most of them do. I'm a very devout Christian. I go to Black Rock Church in Fairfield, and we're actually in the midst of Missions Week this week, believe it or not. And my husband and I had this conversation, and I've had a couple of other people reach out about this. Do you think, with what you know about Ukraine, do you think there will be opportunities, because we've had maternity wards, you know, attacked, we've had kids who are up for adoption, and those places have been attacked. Do you think there will be opportunities for Americans to adopt Ukrainian children?
I think it'll take a while before that sorts out enough legally. You know, they have to be sure that the child is, in fact, an orphan, not just separated. But yes, there's going to be orphans. There's going to be lots of orphans.
And plus, they already exist. Many orphanages in Ukraine, although some have already been bombed. But there are many orphanages throughout the Ukraine, and so there are kids that are available for adoption. But right now, the system is not functional. For that. And plus, I know that we have first-hand knowledge of, or second-hand knowledge of, kids who have been separated from their mom and dad and families, and or grandparents, and are just now. I saw yesterday one child had found his parents finally after, you know, roughly 3 weeks.
Wow,
there have been kids that were sent ahead by themselves to the border because
the
parent had to help an elderly parent who couldn't travel, things like that.
Unbelievable.
Okay, I'm going to leave the rest with my wife because I've got another appointment to go to. So thank you so much.
I thank you both. No, I'm letting you both go, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Frank and Robbie Pack, thank you for the work you do, and thanks for sharing it here on WICC.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you.
I appreciate your prayers and those of your listeners as well, because they surely need them.
Thank you. No question. Appreciate it. Frank and Robbie Pack here on WICC. So the 2022 appropriations bill recently signed by President Biden is actually including $569,000 towards reversing an environmental and economic damage that we've seen caused by as many as a million lobster pots left in Long Island Sound. And we're talking this morning to the Maritime Aquarium. In fact, the president and CEO, Jason Patton, Atlas, is here. And aside from being very well versed on all of this, he also was previously the executive director of Marine Conservation Programs for Wildlife Conservation Society and the former president of the National Marine Sanctuary Foundation. Good morning, Jason. Thanks for being here.
Oh, good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me.
So first and foremost, can you just explain, Jason, what are these lobster pots? What are they?
Well, lobster pots are what lobster fishermen use for lobstering, for catching lobster. In the old days, they used to be made of wood, and currently they're typically made of metal, and they've got some rubberized metal around them, and they sit on the bottom of the water, and And they've got buoys attached to them so fishermen can find them after they're deployed. And then they pull them up with ideally full of lobster. And that's their catch. The lobster fishery crashed in 1999. And so when lobster fishermen looked to pull up their traps at that point, they were empty and empty year after year until they basically just left them abandoned and derelict at the bottom of the Sound.
Okay, so essentially lobster catching doesn't go on in Long Island Sound anymore. And maybe that sounds like a dumb question, but I'm not a fisherman or I love to study it, but I don't know enough about it. But we don't do lobster catching here in Connecticut in Long Island Sound?
No, we don't. There's only a couple of lobster fishermen that still really actively go out for catch of lobster. And they are really struggling. Most of them have moved on to other fisheries, whelk and other fisheries. But lobstering really no longer exists on a commercial scale in Long Island Sound.
Okay, so why were these traps or these pots? Why were they left behind?
Well, I think at some point fishermen would go out. They would spend a lot of money and effort and time to retrieve the traps, and the traps would be empty year after year, month after month, after the collapse in 1999. And ultimately, it just wasn't worth their while to go out and retrieve them anymore. They had no use for them. And even though it was their personal property, they left them at the bottom of the Sound. Ultimately, those buoys get detached, and the traps just sit there. And this is now for decades. And yet those traps are still actively fishing for marine life at the bottom of the Sound. Some lobster find their way in to the extent lobster is still there. Crustaceans, for the most part, find their way into the traps. Occasionally finfish find their way into the traps. And research that's been done on the New York side by the Cornell Cooperative Extension have estimated, as you mentioned at the beginning, anywhere between 700,000 and 1.3 million lobster traps are sitting at the bottom of the Sound. And based on, they've collected about 19,000, almost 20,000 traps over the 10 years that they've been retrieving these abandoned traps. And they say about 30% of these traps are still catching fish, and 90% of these traps are still active, meaning that they're still sitting on the bottom in such a way that fish can come in and be trapped by them.
So that I was just going to say, so they can't get out, and then I would imagine that would kill them because they can't go and get food or resources or move around or anything like that.
So the science is still a little bit uncertain on this in terms of, for example, whether finfish can come in and out. Mm-hmm. And one of the benefits of our research is one of the benefits of this initiative is not only to retrieve the traps and undertake a very significant effort to clean up marine debris, but it's also to do research to see exactly what's going on underneath the surface to see how these traps are still catching fish, whether fish are coming in and out, whether they're staying in for long periods of time. A lot of the traps that have been retrieved on the New York side do have dead marine animals in them. Some still have live marine animals in them. Some are empty. Getting a sense of what exactly is going on is another purpose to our work.
So, I mean, again, the price tag, $569,000 coming from the federal government to remove these traps and to clean things up. How long do you think, in your professional opinion, Jason, how long do you think it'll take to remove all the traps out of Long Island Sound?
So, it will take a lot of years. Cornell, as I said, on the New York side has been doing this for a decade, and they've retrieved almost 20,000 traps. Our proposal, the way we expect to stand it up, and we intend to draw on a lot of the experience on the New York side. Our proposal is for an 18-month project to deploy 50 excursions and pull up 3,000 traps. And this would be really a first project, and then we would scale from there. Look to make it more cost effective. But a lot of the funding in this project will go to fishermen to actually charter their vessels and employ them to be the ones retrieving the traps. They're the ones who know best where the traps are. They're the ones who know how to do the hauling better than academics or better than other folks. And so a lot of the funding will go back to the industry stakeholders and the fishermen themselves to help us with this effort. And a lot of it will go into the work that we are conducting, and a lot of it will go to the other partners in the project, which include Save the Sound and Project Oceanology, both of whom, like us, have been permitted by the state, DEEP, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, to actually retrieve these traps. And again, because it's all private property, we need to be careful. And once we pull them up, we need to look for tags to see if we can identify owners. We need to provide a 30-day period for owners to come and claim the traps if they want. We don't expect a lot will. But again, we need to be very respectful of the fact that these traps at one point did belong to individual fishermen.
And last quick question, Jason, when you do pull up these traps, are they reusable? Could they, I mean, they've been sitting, like you said, for decades under the water, but are they still usable if fishermen maybe in Maine or in Boston, you know, if they wanted to continue on in the lobster industry, but they live out of state, could they use these traps or no, they're pretty much duds at this point?
So theoretically, that's an interesting question. The purpose, though, is to recycle them. There'll be metal, and a lot of that metal can be recycled. Part of the funding for the project will go for working with metal recyclers to crush the traps and get them recycled so that the metal can be repurposed and used for positive activities.
Jason Pantless, the president and CEO of the Maritime Aquarium in Norwalk, we thank you so much for coming on, explaining all this to us, and can't wait to see all the work get started.
I'm looking forward to coming back and telling you, Melissa. Thank you so much for the time this morning. Appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Yes, thank you so much.
It's time to get out and explore.
Melissa in the Morning brings you science you may not know on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Good morning. We are going to be, instead of looking to the skies and checking out the birds, we're going to go below the waters and talk about fish sounds this morning. Good morning, David Mestre. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Who knew that fish could make sounds?
I mean, so it's funny that you say that, because this morning I found one of the stations that Connoisseur owns is called 95.9 The Fox, and we found the mascot tail of the fox. And of course I put it on, and I had to, you know, it's 5 o'clock in the morning. I had to do it. And you know that song, What Does the Fox Say? But nobody actually knows the sound that a fox makes. So that kind of reminds me very much of fish. I have no idea other than bloop. Like, I have no idea what a fish sounds like.
Yeah. And it's really funny because, I mean, what happens is that, you know, we've been listening to the underwater world for a pretty long time. We have all of these underwater microphones. They're called hydrophones. And it turns out that, you know, up until recently, you know, they were pretty expensive. But now, you know, online, you can get yourself an $80 underwater microphone, and you could put it in a pond or a lake or even in Long Island Sound.
Now,
recording.
Does that only pick up fish sounds, or like, can people hear weird conversations that people are having under the water in pools?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So it turns out that the water does carry sound a great distances. So you can have hydrophones in Australia, and even in the southern Pacific Ocean, like thousands of miles away from Antarctica, you can hear ice cracking.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's,
so
for $80, that's crazy.
For $80, yeah,
I'd
you can
buy
get like
that.
A little,
oh
yeah, underwater housing. You know, you can put the whole thing under like Long Island Sound. You can pick up boat sounds. You can pick up sounds of you know, mostly, you know, a lot of different sounds from like you know, ship traffic. But
that
you do
amazing.
Pick up, you know, sounds from, you know, a biological origin, like fish and mammals and those kinds of things. And, you know, for a long time, a lot of these scientists have just been kind of collecting these sounds. And, you know, there was like a book back in 1970 where they had like about, you know, record, not recordings, but actually like pictures of what the sound waves of some of these fish look like. You know, they actually just
I think
just
I have some of them.
And do you have that one? You know, it's
I think
like probably
I do.
Somewhere in some dusty library. But today, because you know we've got the internet and we've got ways of storing digital media, you know there are now efforts to actually collect these sounds into like searchable databases. You know, like one effort is called the Global Library of Underwater Biological Sounds,
wow.
otherwise known as GLUBS.
See, like that sounds like a fish, GLUB.
Yes, yeah,
glub.
Yeah. They're
that makes sense.
Very clever. And also, there's a you can go on to fishsounds.net.
That's what I'm on right now.
Great, you're on fishsounds.net, so you can actually you can hear fish. You know the sounds that fish make, and you would think that wow, you know this is you know we've been studying fish for a very long time, but you know we only actually you know one paper mentioned that we only actually have collected fish sounds for only 4% of fish species. So there's like 96% of fish. We don't know if they make a sound or what sound they even make. But we've only collected a very small sample of fish sounds.
Wow. Wow. Can we play some of them?
Yeah. Let's go ahead and play a couple of fish sounds.
I love when you do this. I think this is so fun. And again, if you guys want to check this out, you can go to fishsounds.net and hear some of the sounds. Okay. Here we go. Haddock, which I think is tasty, but I'd love to hear what it sounds like. All right. Here we go. Oh my gosh. Okay, David, immediately, all I think of is, like, have you ever seen the movie Flubber?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, you know when they have the flubber, the basketball players have the flubber on their hands and their shoes and they bounce really, like,
yep.
high in the air? You know the scene where the guy is bouncing the basketball and it's like...
Yeah.
That's all I thought of. That's what it sounds like. It's like a heartbeat.
Yeah,
nuts.
It's crazy, yeah. Yeah, these sounds are really, you know, it caught me off guard because they sounded like really unique. And you know, the database has to like describe these sounds. So they kind of have like glub or jackhammer or growl, you know, just
it's
to kind of like give you an idea of all the different types of sounds that the fish can make.
Oh my gosh, this is crazy. Like, I want to do more. I think this is so fun. So wait, this is the, is it loose?
Lusitanian toadfish. Oh, go ahead.
Lusitanian toadfish. But they give you two of these. So you've got the sound name is like a croak and the other one's a boat whistle. So let's listen to
both
of them.
Do the boat whistle. Boat whistle's a good one. Yeah,
all right, here we go. Boat whistle.
That was the fish. That was the fish.
Oh my gosh! That sounds like a horrible.
That's it. Yeah.
Sounds like a terrible tummy ache.
Yeah.
Oh no,
that's a Lusitanian toadfish. No, it's calling.
For anyone who's just tuning in, no, I am not having a gassy morning. That is the Lusitanian toadfish. This is so cool. This is so cool. Wait, I want more. Wait, hold on. Gray Gurnard.
What's the gray gurnard?
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
this one.
Is it a bottom feeder? What is this?
Yeah, it looks like a bottom feeder. Like it's got like these kinds of weird fan shaped kind of fins.
Yeah.
And I think it sometimes makes its way to the surface too and can like crawl around. So this is I think I've heard about some fishermen seeing these. So it may be a type of gurnard, you know, where it's like a little bit of a bottom feeder, but it does make its way, I think, to the surface because it has that sort of features that it could probably walk.
Interesting. Here, let's hear this guy. It looks like a growl or a grunt. Oh, I can't wait. Let's
see.
Yep,
growl, grunt. Yeah.
Let's see. It kind of sounded like a chicken a little bit, like
yeah.
Oh my god!
Yeah, but like a low chicken, like a.
But then he got mad at the end. He was like, oh.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. So you know, we're collecting these sounds, and you know, a lot of times, you know, we're hearing the fish, but we have to kind of put it into some kind of context. What are they doing? Are they feeding? Are they spawning?
Right.
Are they, you know, so you know, this is a real.
real mysterious, space in biology where we're like, trying to do these kinds of, acoustic forensic science here to try and figure out, what are they doing? Are they communicating? A lot of times the fish, use these sounds to say, hey, I'm here and this is my territory, or for probably mating and spawning. And sometimes even for just, searching for food and those kinds of things. So, yeah,
that's amazing. So first of all, if anybody wants to hear those sounds again, go to fishsounds.net. But I just realized I would love to even just buy this. It probably sounds insane, but I'd love to know like what a goldfish sounds like. We love our goldfish, Bloop.
Yeah,
his name
yeah.
is ironically
yeah,
Bloop.
Know,
I'd love to.
$80 hydrofoam. Just shove it in that little
in
fish
tank.
And just maybe you know. I mean, who knows what they're doing when you're not watching?
I don't know.
They may have a whole conversation.
I feel like that movie Pets, where they have parties and stuff. I feel like our fish turns on Finding Nemo or something while we're out. He puts on Disney Plus.
They have
Plus
an entire inner life that you don't even know about.
Well, I'm about to find out. I'm going to get one of those microphones. David Mestre, so cool this morning. Thank you so much.
Fishsounds.net. Go find it.
I love it. Making a splash this morning. Thank you so much, David. We'll talk again next week. We have a very big anniversary that we're celebrating here at Connoisseur Media. He's a very dear friend of mine. He's someone that you're very familiar with, and he's been in this industry longer than I've been alive, and that's okay. Danny Lyons is here this morning, and you know him. He has been a host on WEBE 108 for many, many years. In fact, today is your 35th anniversary being on WEBE, our sister station. Holy moly.
Yeah, that's amazing. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's so nice to be up so early with you.
I know.
Melissa,
look at you.
And good to see you.
You look this good this early in the morning. How do you do it, Dan?
I tried really hard
crackers.
Today for you.
Yeah, well, you did. You did it. You succeeded. I mean, 35 years, does it feel like it just kind of flew?
Yeah, it totally flew by. And it's funny because I was, can I say how old I was? Yeah, I was 32 when I started.
So you're my age.
You can do the math. Yeah.
Wow.
And I still feel that age.
Oh, yeah.
I actually started in radio when I was 18, so I still feel like I'm 18 years old. I still feel like a kid. We're in such a great industry.
Yeah, it's so true.
Being in the entertainment business, you don't age mentally.
Mm-hmm.
Getting up off this chair later after we finish talking is going to be a little hard.
I was going to say, I'm losing my hearing from always having headphones on, and it's only been a few years that I've done radio, but Lord, I can only imagine.
And plus all the concerts we went to all those years, all the loud music. Yeah, I do have to have some aid once in a while with my ears and my hearing.
Yeah, I'm nearing that way as well, Dan. Tell us, how you even got into this industry.
It's funny. My high school reunion is coming up, and I just wrote a 200-word little paragraph about how I started in the business, and it was in high school. One of the brothers, I went to a Catholic school in Waterbury, Connecticut, Holy Cross, and one of the brothers recognized that that's what I wanted to do. I knew that when I was 15 years old, that I wanted to be on the radio. I listened all the time to my hometown station, and that's what I wanted to do. And he asked me to be the MC for the band concerts. He conducted the orchestra.
So he
would rent Tux and Tales for me, give me the cue cards, and I'd get up in front of a microphone. That's all I wanted to do was be in front of a microphone.
And so you weren't nervous?
I don't remember being nervous.
Wow.
No.
So it's just natural. You just, yeah.
Yeah. And then I also did the announcements in the morning. Good morning. Today is D-Day. Will the following students please report to their principal's office?
Oh, my gosh.
Or whatever was going on in the school. So I can tell you that I don't remember what the room looked like, but I know exactly what the microphone looked like that I used to do that. And
wow.
That was 50 years ago.
That's amazing.
And right after high school, I applied to all my local radio stations. No one would hire me. And a friend of mine who also wanted to be in radio and I took off to Florida. We flew to Fort Lauderdale. My goal was to hitchhike from Miami back to Connecticut.
No.
Until I got a job at a radio station. Yeah.
Are you serious?
Well, in 1972, I guess it was okay to hitchhike.
Oh, sure. My father did it. Yeah, of course.
Nobody
absolutely.
Would do that today. But
so you were just going to venture up and just see whoever offered you a job, and that was it?
Exactly.
You're just going to stay there?
Had
wow.
no experience. I went to, Miami, I think, was the number one or the number five radio market in the country at the time, and people just laughed at me. Like, what are you doing here? You have no experience?
Gosh.
And I was like, I don't know.
But you went for it.
And I did. And I finally got a job in West Palm Beach. It was a little AM country music station. It was owned by Sam Phillips, who was the head. He
like Phillips? Who?
Sun Recording Studios.
Oh, my gosh.
And that
gosh.
Was, artists like Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry
no
Lee
deal.
Lewis. He was in Memphis, and he owned this little radio station, country station. I went
wow.
there, worked part-time for about a month. I became full-time and did middays, kind of what I do now. and played country music. I didn't know anything about radio or country music.
Do you like country music?
I loved country. When I came back, I couldn't sleep at night unless I had country music on.
That's beautiful.
I couldn't fall asleep. And then I got a job at my hometown station. That was what I, you know, my goal in life was to work there. Listening to all these guys and then being able to work with them was like the biggest thrill of my life.
Mm.
And since then, I've been offered jobs since 1974. And,
wow.
You know, went from there to New Haven. And then that was 13 Waves, was an AM station. And then that became KC101.
Yes, of
big
course.
Station. We put that on the air with Storm and Norman, was one of the original guys.
The
and Kurt Hansen, who was the guy that put Weeby on the air in 1984. We all worked together back then.
Wow.
And that's how we ended up at Weeby together. I left KC101. I went to Hartford to work at TIC-FM. And then Kurt put this station on the air, Weeby, with Storm and Norman. And 3 years after it went on the air, he called me. And, of course, I wanted to come back and work with my friends.
Of course.
And it's been just so much fun.
Yeah. And I do love the fact, for anyone who doesn't know, yeah, Storm and Norman, same guy who's Storm and Norman Gino for the Italian House Party.
Right.
You guys know him very, very well, obviously. You guys are still, like, best friends. When I run into the two of you, I'm always, here they are. You know, you guys are just like meant to, you know, be
together.
Yeah,
the highlight of my day is coming in about 9:45 every morning and just having a crazy conversation with
Norm. You never know. I know.
You
I
never
have those
know
at 4 a.m.
what's going to come out.
Good Lord.
So it's fun.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it puts a smile on my face.
It's so incredible. And I mean, 35 years, what a milestone, Dan.
You know what the secret is?
Tell me.
Show up.
Yeah, sure.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I might have been fired 15 years ago. I don't know. I just keep showing up.
You're like, I don't know. They may have shut my card key off, but by the time I get here, everyone's here, so the building's
and
open.
And I feel like every day I'm auditioning. You know, I hope I pass the audition. I get
so
to keep my job, right?
I feel that way every day. 9:58, I shut it off, and I'm like, whew, we got through.
Right.
We got through without a hitch.
Still get nervous every day, do you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, still have those butterflies.
I play music every morning before I go on. I have like a pump-up song just to make sure my nerves are in check.
Yeah.
And I remember when I first met you, Danny, I was my dad was doing commercials with Weeby and ICC years and years ago, and I was like a preteen, and you were one of the first people I met, and I remember just thinking, oh my gosh, you sound the exact same on the air that you do in real life. Most people kind of put on a voice, you know what I mean? But you are so authentic, and you have such a radio voice.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes.
I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you.
Yes. That's great.
35 years. So what are you going to do?
And look at you. You started as an intern.
I know.
And here you are.
I was one of your
anchoring
interns.
Your own radio show on a great radio station, legendary WICC 600.
Who did you pay off for that?
How long have you been doing the show or at the radio station?
A little over 3 years at the station.
Great. Mm-hmm. And you did TV before. Yeah. Great way to get in.
I know. Well, I mean, you and I were able to stay in touch for so long. I mean, you're one of the biggest reasons that I made my way back here.
I appreciate that.
Well, it's
so
true.
Good to have you here.
Well, it's so good to have you here, actually.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have you here. Yeah. I mean, usually I have to go into the Lion's Den to go see Danny, but you're like, I don't know what we call this. We call this the morning nest.
Melissa's mess.
Exactly. Oh, that's what it is. Yes, it is. Well, Dan, congratulations.
Oh, thank you
35
so much.
Years. So proud. And so I feel super blessed that I've got to learn from you. I get to work with you and be your friend in real life. I feel like one of the lucky ones.
Yeah,
so.
I think that I appreciate that. And I feel the same way. And coming to work for Connoisseur Media every day, they give us the opportunity to do what we love.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't complain about that.
No, you cannot. Danny, appreciate it. And happy 35 years.
Thank you, Melissa.